This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the new episode on New Books Network. Today we have with us Professor Shalja Paik. We are here to discuss her new book, The Vulgarity of Caste, Dalits, Sexuality and Humanity in Modern India. Professor Paik is Associate Professor at University of Cincinnati. She is Staff Distinguished Professor of History and Affiliate Faculty in Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies and Asian Studies. Her research lies at the intersection of fields concerning modern South Asia, Dalit studies, women's studies, oral history, to mention a few. Her first book was Dalit Women's Education in Modern India, Double Discrimination, and recently she has come out with her second book, The Vulgarity of Caste, Dalit Sexuality and Humanity in Modern India, from Stanford University Press. She has also written significant peer-reviewed journal articles discussing the Dalit woman's historiography. A historian by training, her recent work involves rich ethnographic engagement with Dalit women who are at cultural site of tamasha production. It is also first in-depth engagement with tamasha as an art form, exploring and locating its history. Thank you, Professor Paik, for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Kalyani. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about my work. And it is very fantastic that Kalyani has, offered to do this podcast. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Professor Paik. So Professor Paik, your work is an important reflection on the question of Dalit women and their sexuality question. Through the performance of tamasha, you have re-looked into the life world of Dalit women and have argued about what the performance of tamasha means in Dalit women's everydayness, rather than conventionally understanding it through a moral lens of good versus bad. The framework of Manuski and Asli reflects upon the Dalit woman quest to transgress ascribed identities, and it reinforces Dalit performance as a weapon for the weak. Your work is indeed a watershed as it recenters Dalit women's experience in sex, gender, caste complex, rather than looking them as a passive recipient of male-centered Dalit assertion. So Professor Paik, can you briefly reflect upon your journey through this book? How much time did it take for you to engage and understand Dalit women performing tamasha? What interested you to take up this research?
Certainly, Kalyani. Thank you very much for that question. And it is really intriguing because I grew up, you know, in India, and I have now, you know, spent almost like half my life in India and half in the US. But this is, I grew up watching popular arts in Pune city and in my village, Kopargaon, which is in Ahmednagar district. And I watched a number of, you know, musical and dance performances like Tamasha, Gondhar, Jagran, along with films, you know, that were broadcast by Doordarshan, as we called it then. And as a child, I was very excited about these arts. And I even, you know, at times enacted the song and dance of the women. So it was, it was just like, yes, while playing as children, you know, with my cousins, this is what we used to do. So it was mainly during my field research and from 2000 to 2004 for my first book, Dalit Women's Education in Modern India, Double Discrimination, that was published by Routledge in 2014, that I interacted with Tamasha women like Surekha Punekar, Mangalatai Bansode, Simatai Pote. And for this book, I interviewed Dalit women from a range of backgrounds, rural and urban, slums, middle-class apartments, literate and non-literate. And I spent a good amount of time with Tamasha dancers who, you know, mainly led peripatetic lives. The families were constantly on the move. And I spent long hours chatting with Mangalatai Bansode in Pune and in Kada village, Ahmednagar, where she was performing on those two nights. So, as I worked on, understanding their lives for my first book, and after I finished that book, I was thinking about, you know, these questions. And that is where I decided to investigate and to understand, you know, what this popular theater meant. Mainstream scholars have, you know, neglected Tamasha as a performance and, you know, the politics of the sex, gender, caste system, as I call it. And except for one article by the sociologist, feminist sociologist Sharmila Rege, there is no systematic analysis of the social and the sexual life of Tamasha. And so this itself, you know, is a suppression of an analysis of popular art forms. And that is why, you know, when I decided to venture into understanding how Tamasha was actually, you know, rooted in the sex, gender, caste complex and what it meant to Dalits, and most importantly also understanding how it changed over the 19th and the 20th century.
Okay. Thank you, Shalja. I think that's really interesting that you have actually explored the meanings of Tamasha for Dalit women. And my second question also reflects on this, or is culling out from this particular line. So, Professor Paik, it's interesting that in your book you have culled out Dalit women's experience performing Tamasha from a man's experience of it. Was the relationship between Dalit man and Dalit woman in a Tamasha setting conflictual, or were there convergence as well? Can you briefly reflect to our audience about some unique conversations that you had with Dalit women performing Tamasha?
Yeah, certainly. So the book, it focuses on many oral history interviews that I conducted with Dalit women and some men. And here, you know, it's very, first, you know, it's very important. And as a historian, I think this is important to mention that we do not find the stories of these marginalized communities in the quote-unquote official archive. And so, you know, how do you understand life of these people, people who are absent in these, you know, official archives? And most importantly, how do you understand and grapple with the social memory of these communities? So that is how, you know, I have been conducting, you know, oral history interviews even for my first book. So this started in 1999, and that is how I went about in the field talking with the, you know, with my participant, you know, participants or interlocutors, as, you know, we may call them. They were sharing their experiences with me. And it is, you know, while doing this, we see as to how, for example, five generations of Mangalatai's family were involved, have been involved in Tamasha. So her grandparents, her parents, her sisters, brothers, children, and grandchildren, nieces, and a lot of nephews. So clearly, you know, women and men are working together. And we also see as to how, you know, they're also have become rivals. So, for example, you know, Mangalatai's brother and sisters, they have their own groups. And Mangalatai has her own Tamasha troupe. So like for, and similarly, Surekhatai Punekar and her sister Lata Punekar are also, you know, very, very renowned leading Tamasha performers. And they also, you know, have their separate troupes. So we clearly see so they are trying to, you know, build on this Khandani, as they called it, which is basically a family occupation or a hereditary lineage that they're trying to carve out. And this is the caste and the cultural capital. So Tamasha has become, you know, their livelihood for many generations, for, you know, the men, the children, the women in their families. So, for example, as Kailas Narayan Gaukar asserted, and I quote, he said, "We, that is my mother and I, had no other option. There are other businesses too, but Tamasha is our Lakshmi, that is the goddess of wealth. And so this is not business, it is our service to the public. We entertain people forgetting our own sorrows," end quote. So in this manner, we see that Tamasha people, they exploited the cracks in the institution of caste that reduced them to work as laborers and entertainers. And Tamasha people worked at serving dominant caste, you know, men, mostly men who were in the audience, but at the same time, they were very much implicated in the very regimes of power and sexual caste, as I call it, the sexual caste violence that oppressed them. So Tamasha people, yes, women, men, children, even transgender folks, they came, you know, they used it as a cultural and a social capital that they acquired and accumulated, and most importantly, skillfully cultivated over long years.
That's interesting, Shalja, the way you are actually looking into the so-called unconventional archive to explore the social memory and, in fact, rethinking the cultural capital that the players of Tamasha have actually cultivated over a period of time, over generations. So coming to my next question, Shalja, I want to ask you, how have the conceptual categories like Manuski and Asli, through which you have redefined Dalit women performing Tamasha, rethinks the Dalit woman question per se? How can such conceptualization be developed or integrated to the Dalit feminist theorization?
Yeah, certainly. So I think here I would like to talk about my conceptual and, you know, theoretical contributions. And it is very important to understand as to how I have used, you know, Tamasha to basically understand the history of the development of these conceptual categories, and most importantly, what they have meant to Dalits. It was Dalits who actually constructed them. And, you know, that is how they tried to understand their humanity. So Dalits struggled to, you know, recuperate their manuski or dignified humanity, and lift themselves up, raising their moral status in the eyes of the dominant castes and the colonial government to assert their legitimacy, that is the asli status. So here we clearly see that, you know, although, for example, Savarnas, you know, men and women who performed in Tamasha or, you know, Lavanis or in films, you know, these were, you know, very tentative arrangements for them. But it is mainly abject Dalit Tamasha women who were excluded, you know, from such fame, who were excluded from their legitimate and or authentic status, for example. So my framework of manuski, ashlil, and asli, you know, actually provides avenues for Dalit feminist theorization, in that women, and especially here Dalit women, Dalit Tamasha women who have never been considered manus or human, or, you know, striya, or, you know, women, you know, or woman, and authentic, that is asli, they would have now have the opportunity to push against these concepts and, you know, embody these categories and entities. And it is significant to understand here as to how I came upon the concept of manuski. This concept was actually deployed by Dr. Ambedkar. And, you know, we see this especially from the 1920s, when he talks about as to how manuski would enable Dalits to become a person. So Ambedkar, or a human. So Ambedkar deployed manuski to enable a far wider conception and politics of the good, of self-mastery and recognition, embracing practical reason and a broad range of emotions. So to Ambedkar, and I quote here, to be manus is not to behave like a slave. So this is what, you know, Dalits, this is how they would fight against caste slavery. And most importantly, he declared, and I quote, ours is a fight to achieve manuski, end quote. So manuski brought together the moral and material claims about fundamental equality, and it possessed a potential to connect with others across caste, class, political, and religious divisions. However, so here is, you know, we also see, you know, the problems that Ambedkar also left no space in his idea of manuski for Tamasha women, unless they abandoned, quote unquote, you know, this ashleel business, as the larger society called it. So Ambedkar constituted a new Dalit woman through these interrelated ideas of an intrinsically caring humanity. So we have to focus on Ambedkar's commitment and also the contradictions that he was facing, right? So theoretically, you know, he was an absolutely radical in talking about the, you know, the sex, gender, caste complex, have developed in the book, where he shows and he talks about as to how it's all women basically who were oppressed by the sex, gender, caste system. But Dalit women, and this is where I actually extend Ambedkar's theorization to talk about how Dalit women were more oppressed, and most importantly, the so-called disrespectable Dalit Tamasha woman was, you know, the most vulnerable. So, you know, he does this, but at the same time, we also come across, you know, some ambiguities, and that is where we also see that he created binaries of quote-unquote respectable asexual women toiling away in the factories and so-called dishonorable sexual Tamasha women or prostitutes. So, you know, I have dealt with this in details in this chapter on Ambedkar and manuski and, you know, reconstructing of Dalit life worlds. So, however, you know, this strategy of Marinsky, it infused humanism with new knowledge and understanding. And so this moral sensibility is absent in the Savarna-dominated world, which excluded Dalits from fully becoming human, that is, you know, a full manas. So we need to understand these contingencies and the problems that we think about, a theory, but what actually happens on the ground in practice may not necessarily align at all times with our theoretical formulations. And so these are exactly the problems that we come across.
Yes, Shalja, I think your book has actually talked about this question of talking about Dalit women through the lens of humanism, and something that was denied, the humanistic touch that was denied to her within a Savarna framework of thinking. So related to, since you were talking about Ambedkar and his frame of thought when it came to the understanding of the Dalit woman question and how it can be further extended to the process of Dalit feminist theorization itself, I wanted to actually talk about that the dichotomy of morality, immorality, or Ashleel Asli is a recurrent theme of your book. In fact, Dr. Ambedkar in his writings have problematized Dalit women who were into prostitution. How has your book taken forward this discussion on the question of Dalit women as the moral bearers of society? How do you locate Tamasha women within Ambedkar's frame of thought?
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Correct. Yeah. So this is, you know, something that I just talked about. But I think here it is, you know, very important to understand, you know, once again. And I know I am going to reinforce some conceptual and theoretical moves that I have deployed in my book. And so it is very important to understand these changes, you know, historically, and what they mean for us today in, you know, in our present world. So in 1916, you know, Dr. Ambedkar, he launched a critique of Brahmani patriarchy and endogamy, which he called the caste mechanism, as it functioned to regulate the sexuality, social mobility, and economic resources of women, especially surplus, that is, unmarried or unmarriageable women, and thus safeguard a Brahmin power and privilege by preventing these women from seeking intercaste marriages and transgressing the boundaries of the caste hierarchy. So while caste sociality regulated the sexuality of all women, the real sexual violence of caste slavery lay in the differentiation of sexuality and ritual exploitation of untouchable women. So Ambedkar does not mention untouchable women. I am using the word as it was used in contemporary times. So I just want the listeners to pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. So, and Ambedkar does not mention, the prostitute or the Tamasha women. So what I'm doing is I am extending Ambedkar's analysis of the Brahmin surplus woman to the Mahar prostitute. And here I'm specifically, you know, referring to this particular woman that Ambedkar then, you know, would go on and talk to them in the 1930s. So I recognize that the Mahar prostitute or the Tamasha woman does not figure in Ambedkar's 1916 theoretical analysis. If, however, we extend Ambedkar's theorization, we can appreciate the specific nature of her exploitation. her physical labor, which was always open to appropriation. And, you know, she was considered a surplus woman without a legal partner. So the very mode of evaluation that subjected the Brahmin woman to an assessment of her as quote-unquote surplus was additionally weaponized against the Mahar prostitute, as well as those women like Tamasgirs or Muralis, seen to be sexually available and thus associated with her. So in her case, sexual labor was not restricted to marriage or caste. It was obscured and universalized. And by ensuring that all people had access to her laboring body and that all men could claim her sexual body, she was rendered through the sex, gender, caste complex, as I call it, both surplus and constantly available. And although many Tamasha women were married and they had monogamous relationships, they bore children, especially sons, elites viewed them as surplus women operating outside the marriage or family scheme, and as such characterized them as having, you know, flexible sexual arrangements, and that is why they became ashlil. And so to elites, Tamasha women were excess women, and both surplus to and yet significant within the economy of caste. And this excess was doubled through Tamasha, which its critics viewed as a vulgar indulgence within an economy of excess. And so, you know, on the first glance, when Ambedkar critiqued this sex, gender, caste complex, it seems that it, you know, as, you know, some scholars have said that, you know, it's a patriarchal move. However, the problem is, you know, is deeper. We need to understand and really pay attention to the building of Manaski. And so, you know, we see that Ambedkar critically analyzed this connection between caste and the position of women and how Dalit Tamasha women suffered more deprivation, social exclusion, and harassment from untouchable men because of caste violence and untouchability. And, you know, he had recognized how Dalits, you know, were depicted, and Dalit women especially as a whole were depicted as prostitutes by dominant caste people, and all Shudras as, you know, Chandals. So, and because of their caste status, and you know, he reminded them, and, you know, that they were looked upon as degraded. And so as a result, you know, he really worked hard and was committed to stopping the sexual exploitation of Dalit women and also, you know, reinscribe new standards of respectability. So the primary focus, however, at the same time, you know, these are the tensions that we come across. So the primary focus on the struggle against caste slavery, however complicated Dalit women's relationship with their samaj, as, you know, this is where, as Kalyani was pointing out, they became moral, you know, bearers of this respectability that Dalits were trying to carve out. So, but these are the tensions, and, you know, I talk about them in chapters on, you know, Paulabai, this leading Tamasha performer, you know, who is a contemporary of, you know, of course, you know, she performs, you know, even before Ambedkar, but, you know, these are the tensions that we come across when Ambedkar refuses to use the money that, you know, was donated by, that was not, you know, that Paulabai's companion partner wanted to donate to Ambedkar's struggle.
Yes, Shalja. So let me ask a slightly different question now. So, again, in your book, you have talked about Tamasha performance. But within the discourse of performing arts, where do you locate a performance like Tamasha? Would you refer to it as a postmodern performance that recenters the decentered identity? What has the performing art like Tamasha meant for the quote-unquote new Dalit woman?
Yeah, thank you very much, Kalyani, for that question. Because, you know, it really gets to the question of performance and especially, you know, caste, sociality, as people, especially those of, you know, scholars of performance studies and others who are trying to revive the art forms, or have expressed as to how, you know, some people may not find them exploitative and so on and so forth. So there are many ways and many lenses to look at the issue. However, for me, I am not merely recentering Dalit Tamasha women, but I am invested in illuminating how this secular traveling popular theater is branded as ashleel, which is vulgar, and bibhatsa, which is disgusting, by the larger society. And this is per the morally driven modern ethic of the pre-colonial, the colonial, the post-colonial state, the elites, you know, the upper caste, middle class, you know, a dominant high caste, savarnas, and ordinary people. And so I have focused on how we can understand this by looking at the sex, gender, caste complex, as I call it, which is basically the structural complexities of sexual and gendered arrangements of the caste system as they have operated to oppress Dalit Tamasha women. And to investigate these entangled histories, I developed the sex, gender, caste complex, the sexual caste violence, and the ashleel manuski asli complex, as you know, it was embodied by surplus women. And so I analyze these. I analyze the conjugated oppression of vulgarity, caste, sexuality, class, gender, and popular culture, and illuminate how this came about in the 20th century and how different actors like the British or the high caste, the Maharashtra state, and Dalits engaged with, you know, the so-called rowdy and carnivalist tamasha for their own purposes. And then, you know, clearly, you know, we see that tamasha women were, you know, very much aware of these new transformations and these, you know, they were involved in self-making and, you know, reconstructive practices throughout, you know, the 20th and most importantly into the 21st century. The last chapter is about Mangalatai Bansori that I know I mentioned in the talk today, and also, you know, Megha Ghadge, and the conclusion features how, you know, Megha Ghadge or women like Mangalatai or Surekha Tai Punekar, you know, have formed an acquisitive, responsible, and, you know, yes, a self-interested ethic, but at the same time, it is also, you know, important for them to remake themselves and their families, which are dependent on them. So a new generation of artists have transformed the meaning and practice of tamasha in the context of new political sexual caste economy, as I call it. They were agents in creating and preserving, you know, masti, which is historically produced in tamasha. They displayed wealth and they all at the same time preserved their honor, identity, personhood, and name before others. Some leading tamasha women also enjoyed the pleasure of power and continued to negotiate precarious public political realms. Tamasha women, they rearranged complex ideological relationships of assimilation or challenge for different purposes, right? There are no clear binaries, but we clearly see how they are, you know, mediating these processes. And Mangalatai's stigmatization, it ensures the consistent reproduction of Dalit labor for a sexual caste economy, because her degraded and stigmatized body and being a Dalit Tamasha woman is intimately tied to the valorizing of the respectable Marathi and Indian womanhood. So we also come across those processes. And so to negotiate these politics, Mangalatai and her children and her family members, they asserted and culturalized Dalit identity by capitalizing on their particular caste culture, which they called, you know, Khandani, and which becomes Asli. And this is how they, re-inscribe this. And most importantly, also reinforce their right culture, caste-based, right, to tamasha performance. So, you know, these are the complicated circuits that I have illuminated in the book. And, you know, in the process, we see as to how tamasha women provided livelihood and social and economic mobility for the future generations. Yet at the same time, this khandani, as they call it, rooted in the sexual caste economy, also reproduced lowness, the ashleel, and offered few positives beyond economic rewards. So these are the various tensions that I write in the book.
That's really interesting, Shalja. I mean, to understand the new theorization of performance itself, because somewhere the existing theorization or the existing concepts through which performing arts or the vocabulary of performing arts have been built have been too exclusive, and it has actually become a misfit to understand Dalit performances. So I think your work through conceptual categories like Manuski, Asli, there are new ways through which the performing arts like tamasha can be reimagined and rethought. So to my next question, Shalja, I would like to hinge back to something that you began with about the question of archives and how you have to move beyond the conventional archives, look into social memory, so on and so forth, to understand this the social of tamasha itself. So if you can talk about some of the challenges that you faced as a historian to work with oral narratives and explore history of tamasha performance that were not conventionally archived.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thank you for that question. And this is, you know, it's very exciting because it gets me to talk about, you know, moving beyond the institutional, you know, so-called archive, official archives. And that is where it is in the field of tamasha that I can actually interact with, you know, people and their ideas, their actions, and, you know, how they want, you know, how they live and, you know, what they want to do with their lived experience. So I have found that, you know, very, very generative. So I followed tamasha people and, you know, as they performed in Pune, in Mumbai, in Ahmednagar, Narayangaon. And, you know, it was a very unique experience for me as a woman to enter these hitherto forbidden masculine spaces of unbridled masti, you know, yes, in both, you know, open theaters as well as enclosed auditoriums like Bal Gandharva in Pune or Damodar Hall in Parel, Mumbai. So this is where I, you know, found some differences in terms of, for example, you know, the rural and the urban, in terms of open theaters and enclosed auditoriums. So, and I talk about this in a section on the Tamasha Archive in the introduction. So, you know, listeners could take a look at, you know, a deep, and that provides, you know, in-depth look on how I navigated these spaces. And most importantly, I found, you know, it was most importantly in the urban auditoriums, where, you know, I found that they were more gender segregated, and it was very difficult to record the display of men's energetic and enthusiastic masti, even on my iPhone camera, because there was no light in this dark theater, right? It was pitch dark. It was difficult to capture, you know, men on the camera. But at the same time, you know, during, for example, and so these were performances which was, yes, the audience was mainly, you know, men. So I had to really, you know, move very discreetly and capture whatever I could on, you know, on the camera from different angles. So sometimes, you know, from the wings of the stage or the front row or the sides and the back. And because, you know, I did not want to disturb the men in the audience, you know, with my womanly presence. And yes, I at the same time, you know, because I was the only woman who was, you know, moving around, for example, with a camera, recording them on my camera. And so I had to be very brisk. And because, you know, they were, you know, very, some of them infuriated, or, you know, maybe some of them were amused and, you know, as what I was actually doing. But at the same time, you know, you feel that, oh, you don't belong. You feel out of place because people are trying to make their own, they're having their own entertainment, and and they don't want any other woman to watch them, you know, what they are doing. So I mostly sat in the front rows in the theater, or sometimes, you know, with, like, there were just maybe like two, four women maybe sitting mainly in the front rows, especially because they also did not want to, you know, attract attention, and also wanted to be safe, I have to say. And these were mainly women who, you know, must have been, you know, family members of these dancers on stage. So I felt, you know, I just sat with them. And, you know, especially when this theater full of men was narrowly, you know, looking at, you know, narrowed their eyes to, you know, look at me. And, you know, I'm sure they must have thought, as, you know, who is this woman? Yes, middle class looking and so on. And, you know, and fair, yes, we have a problem of colorism. And, oh, you know, what are you doing in this our dark, oversexed, manly space? I'm very sure they thought that, and that is why, you know, people were uncomfortable. And on top of that, I also was trying to record them. So, you know, and I also at times, you know, sat in the back of the theater because I just wanted to observe the full sensual and performative spectacle between the artist and the audience, and, you know, what was actually happening. So so this is how I just moved through different parts of the theater in order to understand how the performance was, you know, carried out, and also the performance between the audience and the actors, and, you know, what they were trying to do.
That's interesting. In fact, a very rich field experience, talking about very mundane little aspects of watching a performance, but at the same time reflecting on, you know, the larger ways in which the act of looking, the act of recording, at the social meanings that goes around it. So to my last question, Shailja, I want to ask you that as a postscript to your book, do you think other forms of Dalit performances led by Dalit low-caste women can be read together along with the tamasha performance? Can the caste resistance through performance have a converging anti-caste sentiment despite diverging histories?
Yeah, thanks, Kalyani. So yes and yes. So certainly, you know, we need to do a lot of deep work and, you know, reading and learning and reflecting on how Dalits and other low castes worked on performance, and, you know, what that actually means to them, and, you know, how they have articulated their ideas and actions and their lives, and, you know, what does this actually mean socially, sexually, you know, politically, ideologically. And so that is where I think, as a historian, I would like to you know, pursue those lines of thought, and we can certainly do that. And on your second question, yes, you know, certainly, you know, songs, skit, dialogues, music can certainly, you know, converge and certainly provide a robust anti-caste critique. So it is mainly for the researcher as to, you know, how do you want to do this? how do you want to read this and what can you make of this? So it can certainly be done.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor Shalja. That was a really interesting conversation with you. Your book has, I do consider it's a watershed moment to understand the performance of Tamasha. In fact, one of the first kind of in-depth engagement with Tamasha as an art form, exploring and locating it in its history, which has largely been missed out somewhere within the so-called mainstream historical imaginations. So thank you again, Professor Shalja. I look forward to the audiences reading this book and further conversations around this books. So thank you, Professor Shalja, for the talk.
Thank you very much, Kalyani. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks a lot. And I hope listeners will, you know, take some time to, you know, think about these deeper questions and also look at these performances and, you know, what these actors are actually thinking and doing and how they have lived their lives. So thank you very much.
Thank you.